Welcome back. It's Fan Drive Time. Hope you're having a nice Wednesday and a nice drive home. We're an hour out from Leafs Predators. I'm Blake Murphy, joined by Shai Davidi today and for the rest of the week. We'll be talking to Adnan Virk shortly. But while we have a minute, you had 5 minutes to sit with my conspiracy theory about the Jays not revealing their outfield dimensions until their roster's complete. This is an out-of-the-park baseball thing I do. I'll tweak the... I have spent my entire baseball watching life very upset that the Colorado Rockies have never managed to, like, build a roster that properly takes advantage of Coors Field. So I do that. Are the Jays doing a little bit of that?
Yeah, that was interesting. So I've actually been pressing people all off season long trying to get the dimensions, and, you know, the Blue Jays haven't wanted to reveal it. So is it a conspiracy theory? I don't know if it was necessarily by design. I do believe there are some construction things that had to happen that would have maybe led to, you know, little bits of difference here and there. And so you announce it and then you change it and then people ask questions. So once enough pieces are in place, I think that's why they're doing it the way that they are. But I do feel that the Blue Jays tailored or at least thought about their outfield defense knowing that the dimensions were going to be different. And the outfield is going to be, it's not going to be a cookie cutter outfield. There's going to be some different shapes in there. There's going to be some weird angles. And that meant that you need guys who know how to play defense in a more significant way.
Premium on outfield defense, another ground ball heavy pitcher, and a couple of lefty bats with pull side power.
Yeah.
I don't know. Could be something there. I'm curious to see. And I know that they said...
They also got good players, right?
Yeah.
It's not like we have... It's in a vacuum. But they do seem to fit a little bit. But I think in general, you're playing in the American League East. Like, you better get dudes who can handle the American League East.
Yeah, good players will play anywhere is probably the Occam's razor here. But I like a little conspiracy theory underneath it.
Why not?
Let's see what Adnan Virk, our pal from MLB Network and NHL Network, thinks. Adnan Virk, the Toronto Blue Jays have not revealed the exact specifications of the ballpark for next year. Are you with me that maybe they are holding off because they want to see, or they wanted to see exactly how this roster turns out and tweak accordingly?
Blake, I'm always with you, first and foremost. Good to talk with you and Shai. But I don't go down that line of thinking. I'm all for a good conspiracy theory. Not exactly Oliver Stone, but I like people who like to dig a little deep. But I don't think that's the case. I think the roster is pretty much known as constructed. I think if this was early December, you say, okay, I don't know who they're targeting. Everyone keeps saying left-handed bat. Is it going to be Brian Reynolds? Are they getting an arm? Who's it going to be? Blah, blah, blah. But as it stands now, like, all the big guys have gone. And maybe they still do get Brian Reynolds, but now they got Brandon Belt. That's probably their answer as far as filling that left-handed bat and replacing Teoscar Hernandez. Obviously, have increased their defense with Kiermaier. So, no, I think at this point, it kind of just is what it is. I don't think there's any necessarily purpose behind it. I was amused the Tigers changing their center field, bringing that in 10 feet. Let's help out Miggy one last year here. Let's get Cabrera home runs, whatever it takes. But, no, I think in this case, the Jays know what they're doing, and I think the roster's improved.
So the Blue Jays signing good players just because they're good, not quite as interesting an off-season story. But, Adnan, this Carlos Correa story, how is that being received on your end at MLB Network? I imagine Mets fans who shelled out $1 million in single-game ticket sales the day that that was announced, people have to be reeling on the Mets side of this.
No question, Shai. I mean, I live in North Jersey here, Bergen County, which is filled with Yankees and Mets fans, and I have friends who are devoted followers of both teams, and the Mets fans are furious. You know, part of the reason why they were so excited, as you said, to shell out the money, says Correa is a star. Now, it's easy to disparage him, and I've heard people say that. Well, he's a 270, 275 hitter. He hits at 25 home runs. He doesn't hit 35 home runs. He doesn't hit 300. He's not going to drive in 100. But you know, and Shai knows, and we all know, they love war in this game. And his war last year, 5.4. War before, 7. Like, he's an outstanding defender. Everyone knows that within the game, people love Correa. And if you're just a casual baseball fan, you definitely know him because he shines when the games matter most. And he hits that home run and says, what time is it? And he's won a World Series. He's won Rookie of the Year. He's been an All-Star, et cetera. So I think the Mets looked at that total package and said, along with being a really talented player. He's charismatic. Like, he's a star. Like, I think he's got real sizzle to him. I've met Correa a couple times. Remember, he came to ESPN when I was there. Fedora, which I love. I'm a huge Fedora guy. Hugging it out on first introduction. Like, very, very charming guy. Now, I think for the Mets fans, they said, this is what we need. We need one more bat. And you pair him with Lindor. Like, that left side is filthy. But if you look at their roster overall, I don't think he's, like, essential to the team. They got Escobar at third. They got Beatty at third. Yes, he obviously lengthens their lineup, but I love that addition. But right now, the Braves are the better team on paper. And I think the Mets are definitely a playoff team, but they're not better than Atlanta. And I think that's the frustration for Mets fans. They go, all right, we did what we needed to do theoretically. Got Diaz back, got Ottavino. You know, we've obviously improved our roster, but we really wanted this big fish. We didn't get it. And by the way, Steve Cohen really wanted him, too. He wants a star. He loves stars. He's an owner who wants to steal some headlines from the Yankees and so on and so forth. But apparently the rumor is it was the ankle. That's why the physicals kept getting failed. And the Mets doctors basically said, hey, you've probably got like 4 or 5 good years, but eventually this guy's going to get hurt. Like, it's not going to go 11 years. So that's why it was almost like, all right, can we go 5 or 6 years of big money? Ultimately, Minnesota steps up for that 6 years, 200. I wonder what's going through Correa's mind. He went for like 330, 315, 200. Again, it's more money than the rest of us would ever dream of. But I'm curious what his conversations are like with Scott Boras right now. But yeah, in answer to your question, Blake, at MLB Network, I've never seen this before, right? From now on, every time someone says he's signed pending a physical, we're going to think of Correa and say they got to do the physical. Otherwise, who knows what could happen?
Yeah, it's funny when you talk to people when a deal comes, you'll often hear either agents or executives stress pending physical. And most of the time, I'm just kind of like, all right, you know, this is just this technical thing that we say, but it was a real thing this time around. And then you mentioned Steve Cohen's role in this and, you know, very, very unorthodox. He made public comments before this deal was finalized. And he said, we needed one more thing, and this was it, telling that to John Heyman of the New York Post. What do you think the fallout is, if any, for him? And do you think the Mets react to this in some way, shape, or form by trying to make something else happen right now?
Well, I think he's kind of corrected the fact, Shai, that early on he was on Twitter quite a bit, making comments, critical, et cetera. Like, he's pretty much shut that down. He hasn't been as much on social media. You're right. My buddy John Heyman will get him to talk, especially if he's in Hawaii, asking Cohen what his thoughts are. But I think he's been a little bit more careful in putting all his comments out there. You know, there's this tendency to try to say he's a new era Steinbrenner, but he really isn't. Like, you and I know, you know, George was bombastic and frustrating and rash and impetuous. And Cohen isn't those. He really wants to win, and he's got a lot of money. So that definitely makes him Steinbrenner-esque. But he's not, like, running out Buck Showalter and threatening to fire him the way George was with Billy Martin. He's not threatening to overhaul his roster and, like, you know, screaming profanities every night. So I think he's a smart guy and he's a calculated guy. He's a very rich guy who, you know, grew up being a Mets fan. He's got this amazing toy now. But I think right now in his heart, he's probably a little frustrated with the situation, no question. Maybe he's a little regretful he said that to John, because now obviously the Mets fans are going to say, well, who's your one piece? You said you were one piece away. But I think deep in his heart, in his brain, he says this was the right decision. I don't want to give $315 million to a guy if he's going to be damaged. And if you talk to any rich person, what I notice mostly about them is they're risk averse. Like, you have to spend money to make money, but they don't like being stupid with money. Like, they are very, like, they might spend $100 million to make $200 million, but they're not going to be silly about money either. If someone tells them this isn't worth it, they're risk averse. So I think Steve Cohen is frustrated. He's annoyed by the process. But ultimately, he's glad they didn't sign a guy who he didn't feel like was the answer, especially when he talked to his team doctors.
I have not talked to that many rich people, Adnan. I don't have a big enough sample. I'm still hoping – we're going to pivot to football here. I'm still hoping Tony Khan, he of the Jaguars and of a professional wrestling company and Fulham FC, eventually responds to my DMs, and I can have one billionaire friend. For now, we wait. I do want to pivot to football, though, because it's a – you know, baseball – transactions are fun, couple months away still from games. Football, we're a couple days away. I know your Eagles aren't playing this week. They've got that bye, but we do have a handful of pretty interesting ones, including my Jacksonville Jaguars, a Trevor Lawrence, Justin Herbert battle, Adnan. Does that scratch the itch for you in terms of young quarterback against young quarterback on a stage this big?
No question, Blake. I mean, I can't believe the fact. I was talking with my neighbors today about all the games, and I said, well, obviously the best game is Brady and the Bucs against the Cowboys. I mean, that number is just going to be gigantic. for my former employer, and Dallas, who obviously can't win on the road, Brady, who never loses to the Cowboys, and just threw for over 4,000 yards again. Like, that's going to be awesome, especially as you've noted, as an Eagles fan, I can't stand the Cowboys, and I'm pretty confident that Brady and the Bucs get the win. But when I looked at the rest of the games, I said, Seahawks 49ers, again, I love the upset for Seattle because I want San Francisco out of there because an Eagles fan, I'm very scared of San Francisco, but I can't see that happening. Bills, Dolphins, with or without Tua, and we know Skyler's going to be the guy. They're not going to win against the Buffalo Bills. We all know this. Vikings and Giants, again, I don't think it's particularly sexy. I could see the Giants winning the game. Dable's a great coach. The Vikings have more talent, especially with Jefferson, but they feel fraudulent, right? You feel like, hey, 11 wins by one score, like they're not that great. And then you look at the Ravens and Bengals, and with Lamar being out, I still can't imagine he dons a Superman cape and is able to beat Joe Burrow and the Bengals. Which brings us to your Jaguars. I'm pretty amazed that, to me, that's the second most compelling game of the weekend. Like, when you have kids, you start to look at the schedule, okay, where can I, you know, kind of find my moment to enjoy the games? And for me, it's always at night. I'm always like, okay, Saturday night, Sunday night, Monday night, I can lock in, put the kids to bed, away we go. So I am ecstatic, not only with the matchup, with the schedule. I'm like, no, I'm going to be locked in here. I'm a man, Doug Peterson. And as you mentioned, what drives the sport more than anything is quarterbacks. And you've got two exciting young quarterbacks in that game. Again, Burrow, Lamar is pretty special as well on Sunday night, if Lamar's healthy. But I think the fact that Jaguars have shown a little bit of moxie here late, the fact they're at home, it really feels like they win. Now, the Chargers are the better team. And Herbert, I mean, if you're a football fan, everyone has a man crush on Justin Herbert. You look at him and you feel like you're watching Joe Montana and John Elway all wrapped up in one. But I think the Jaguars win. And again, I'm not a gambler, but I like looking at the lines. And when I see Jaguars minus one, that tells me even the smart guys in the desert say, this is going to be the best game of the weekend because we don't know who's going to win.
It's interesting hearing you call the Vikings fraudulent. I thought for a second Arash Madani had stolen your phone or something there. But yes. I mean, when you're looking at the teams, at the matchups, is there anyone else that you think this team is a mirage? Like, you know, obviously the Vikings and with Kirk Cousins and his inconsistencies there, they've got some questions to answer. But who else do you look at and say, this looks really flimsy to me?
I texted Arash from the Vikings rig, just getting doused against Matt Ryan and the Colts. And his response simply was Kirk Cousins. And then, of course, they come back and pull off the miraculous win. And then he's back on with Kirk Cousins. So you're right about Madani and his well-worn love of the Vikings. But in terms of the fraudulent teams, I just hate the fact, Shy, a sub-500 team can make the playoffs. That, to me, is just such an eyesore, especially now the 17-game schedule. So I know Brady walks on water, but the fact you were in such a lousy division and now you get a home playoff game, I mean, again, I am rooting for them beyond all reason just to beat the Cowboys because of my disdain and loathing for Jerry's team. But after that, I can't imagine them going much further. I mean, ultimately, your schedule is what you are. If you're an 8-9 team, even with Tom Brady, how on earth can you be expected to win three games and somehow get to a Super Bowl? So I just look at Tampa Bay and say, all right, I do like them against Dallas for a variety of reasons, notwithstanding Dak hasn't looked sharp the last game. But I think that Brady and the Bucs, you go, if you really believe Brady and the Bucs are a Super Bowl contender, you're really diving deep into nostalgia and avoiding what is the recent results.
The recent results with Tampa Bay, yes. I'm most curious about Tom Brady's future, not to, you know, start shoveling dirt on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers season already. Tom Brady's 45. He led the league in completions and passing attempts this year. He was sacked at a lower percentage rate than any other quarterback in football. Doesn't seem like the performance suggests he's going to hang it up, and we have rumors already about which teams, like the Raiders, might be interested in Tom Brady this offseason. Let's say the Bucs get bounced this weekend. What's the most interesting Tom Brady path for you this offseason?
I'm with you, Blake. I don't think he goes back to the Bucs, and I'm with you that he's going to keep playing. I mean, in a very simple terms, he retires for however number of days, literally has to look after his kids because okay, there's no way I'm doing this. Are you kidding me? I got to run after these guys all day and take them like swimming class. I'm like, oh, no, I'm not doing this. Forget that. And Giselle's like, no. You said you'd retire. I sacrificed my career. No way, baby. I'm going to play football. You think he's going to endure a divorce and just go back for one season? No way. And especially he's going to endure an 8-9 season. He is not going to have that on his resume as his final season. He is way too prideful and he's way too good. as you said earlier in the year, I hadn't looked at the numbers, Blake. I just assumed Brady had finally been fallible, as all players will be, at 45. But no, like, his numbers are still great. Like, he's still well above average. He's still a guy who's a top 10 quarterback in football, which is ridiculous. And I think the Raiders one is the most tantalizing, because you say, wow, imagine him and Devontae Adams, give him that great receiver, and then give him Josh McDaniels, who has failings as a head coach, but is, you know, really well documented as a good offensive coordinator. So to me, that's the one that kind of feels sexy. The Dolphins is an interesting one, too. Apparently him and Stephen Ross are good friends. Tua with all these concussions, who knows what his career could be. If he really loves Florida, imagine if he says, well, I'll go from Tampa Bay to Miami and go to that fan base and all of a sudden give them a huge boost and contend, by the way, in the same division as my former team and Bill Belichick and the Patriots. I think the Raiders is the most exciting one, because you could see them saying, yeah, 5 years, $100 million guaranteed. Like, you can play till 50, Tom, whatever it takes. I mean, with Mark Davis, with that haircut, nothing is out of the question. But I think the Dolphins could be in play as well.
And then, you know, I was, just because of the way it worked out, I was able to go to the season opener in Dallas with the Cowboys and the Bucks. The Blue Jays happened to be playing a series. They got done in time, and myself and Mike Cantor from the Toronto Sun, we walked over from one stadium to the other, and it was great. But it was a terrible football game. And you watch those two teams in that game. And first game of the season, look, you understand. But neither one of them looked like a team that was capable of making the playoffs. Prescott got hurt early in that game. He was out. There was like one touchdown, and it was barely any entertainment value. What went right for these teams? You know, how did the Cowboys end up being 12-5? How did the Bucks find a way into the playoffs and get to this point where, you know, they're one of the marquee matchups this weekend?
Yeah, I think the Bucks in many ways beneficiary of a terrible division. Like, let's be honest, the fact that the Falcons and the Saints were still in the mix and Tampa Bay was able to outlast them, that speaks volumes to a bad schedule. But you're right. If you're truly a porous team, you'd go 4-13. So you had to do something good. And Brady, I think, in the offense made enough positive contributions that they were able to get things done. I think, by the way, Todd Bowles did a good job coaching later in the season, kind of figured out his team's strengths and weaknesses, was able to make some adjustments. When it comes to Dallas, the strange thing here is this. Their defense is very strong. When I look at their team, I go, wait, their defense can really put fear in opposing quarterbacks' hearts. And at their best, they can be blitzing and frustrating and very difficult to play against. Now, Dak, when he's rolling, as he did against my Eagles previously, he was unbelievable. Like, he was like 20 of 20 against zone defense. I'm like, my goodness, he's put up 350 yards. No problem. He could pick apart secondaries. But Dallas's flaw has been the inconsistency of their quarterback. And I never would have thought, as much as, again, I find this team loathsome, I've always said Dak's a top 10 quarterback. I don't even think there's any question. And yet this year, there was way too many moments that he was letting the team down. So I think for Tampa, quite simply, their offense did enough, particularly Brady, and they made adjustments where need be as the season wore on and a soft schedule. And the Cowboys, surprisingly in many ways, built on defense. Like, I think at their best, they can be a team that will cause turnovers and cause havoc for Brady. And that's why it's so exciting. You say Tampa's offense against Dallas's defense, strength versus strength.
So, Adnan, in addition to being, you know, everything we need on baseball and hockey and football, you are also the host of the Cinephile podcast, which, of course, all ears on that here at award season. And you know, not a big deal. You have some hardware, I guess, on the TV side, not the movie side, but you have a little hardware yourself come award season. The Golden Globes were last night. Any big gripes with the award winners from the Golden Globes here in between this and the Oscars?
No, Blake, it was very predictable. Right before the awards were on, I know you actively follow my Twitter. I said, I'm on NHL Network tonight. I will not be live tweeting, but here are my predictions. And I pretty much nailed them all. I mean, Michelle Yeoh, best actress for musical comedy. I knew that would happen. Cate Blanchett for Tar, drama, again, as expected. I knew Colin Farrell would win for The Banshees of Inisherin. A lot of talk that was musical or comedy, best actor. A lot of focus on Brendan Fraser for good reason, Redemption Trail. And I love The Whale. But I said, there's no way he's going to win. He's publicly boycotting the Globes because he said he was the object of some gross misconduct years ago. So I said, there's no way he's going to win. Austin Butler's going to win for Elvis. By the way, great film and a tremendous performance, star-making role, and the kind of film the Globes love. big, splashy musical. So all of that happened. I said, Spielberg, of course, is going to win for director. He's one of the great directors of all time, and this is his passion project. As he has said, they gave me $40 million to work through therapy and make this movie about my parents, and as expected, The Fabelmans won Best Drama. The only surprise, and I was happy to see it, was the Banshees of Inisherin won for comedy over Everything Everywhere All at Once. But it feels like those three movies will really be pushing towards the Best Picture Oscar. If you look at The Fabelmans, what do movie people love? Movies about movies, especially when it's one of the great directors of all time. It's a terrific cast, Michelle Williams, Paul Dano, the great Judd Hirsch in a cameo. It really hits all the beats, and it could be Spielberg's first directorial Oscar, since we're going way back to the late 90s and Saving Private Ryan, and 5 years before that, he'd won for Schindler's List. Banshees I had as my best picture of the year. Wonderful, dark Irish comedy. Farrell's going to get nominated and may beat Frasier for the actor Oscar. It may be Austin Butler. That's a great three-horse race for best actor. McDonough's going to win the screenplay for best original. He won last at the Globes, and he'll win as well. If you know his name, of course, he did Three Billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri, which is one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. But then you've also got the fact that Everything Everywhere All at Once is the one that could really upset the apple cart. And that's one of those movies, Blake, as you know, movie people love because it's audacious and it's strange and it's transcendent and doesn't always work, but it takes chances. So it's really going to be fun to see which movie the Oscars say, what are we rewarding? The safe choice in The Fabelmans, the crazy choice in Everything Everywhere All at Once, an A24 film that cost $8 million, somehow made $100 million, or is it going to be The Banshees of Inisherin on this dark Irish comedy, very violent, but a splendid quartet of actors. So no real surprises last night. Our boy Mike Gentile was tweeting how much he hated the Globes. I wasn't as angry as he was. Although I didn't think Gerard Carmichael, particularly good host, his opening monologue wasn't funny. It was kind of serious and odd, to be honest. And Jennifer Coolidge has the odd distinction of being one of the worst presenters of the night, a terrible rambling speech, and one of the great winners of the night. Her speech was hilarious and fantastic. And a real surprise, back to your point, Ke Huy Quan winning for Best Supporting Actor. That was a very pleasant surprise. First Vietnamese actor to win a Golden Globe. He was in the Spielberg film, Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom. And that was his speech. He said, I thought I topped my life as a child actor working with Spielberg. And then for years I've worked in obscurity, and now I get this role in this crazy film, and now I'm here again. It was such a grateful, humble speech. I was so happy for Ke Huy Quan. That was probably the big surprise, him winning supporting actor. And probably the best moment, Eddie Murphy winning the Cecil B. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement and taking yet another shot at Will Smith.
And then it's really interesting to hear you talk about Everything Everywhere All at Once. And comedies, there seems to be a bias in the industry against comedies, right? Recognizing comedies and awarding them. Why is this one different?
Well, I think because it just takes so many chances, and it's honestly uncategorizable. Like, I remember when it came out in April, I said, well, I just don't have any interest in this because I don't know what it is. And somebody asked me, I go, well, what is it? I go, I don't know. I read these reviews. They just go, it's kind of like a science fiction movie, kind of like The Matrix. And I'm the one guy who's not crazy about The Matrix. I said, well, it's just not my cup of tea. Like, I know it's a beloved film franchise, but I don't really like, you know, people time shifting, time travel, different zones, floating, levitating, like whatever. Is this like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? Okay, it's just not my deal. But they said, no, it's amazing. It's not just science fiction. It's comedy, and it's really moving, and it's dramatic. And I said, again, it just doesn't sound appealing to me. And then I finally got sucked into the vortex. As I saw, I kept making $3 million, $3 million, $3 million every week in the box. If it's still there, hanging in there, people are still going word of mouth. And I think the Oscars can love a film like that, that has that kind of buzz and that sleeper hit. But for the movie itself, I think what's great about it is what Gene Siskel once said about Fargo, which is also one of my favorite movies ever. And Siskel said, the late great film critic, he said, the reason why, and he had Fargo, by the way, top 10 all time. Gene Siskel probably saw 5,000 movies in his life. He goes, top 10 all time. And his reasoning was this. He said, Fargo hits so many different genres and does it expertly. It's a comedy. It's a murder mystery. It's a film noir. It's drama. It's a women's picture. It's all these different things. And Everything Everywhere All at Once is a comedy. It's a drama. It's a mother-daughter movie. It's science fiction. It's about the immigrant experience. It's silly. It's wacky. It's funny. It's risky. It's brave. So I think because of that, it is the ultimate throw everything in the kitchen sink at the screen. And I had it as my number four best picture of the year. And I said in my review, I don't think it always works, but when it does, it's amazing. And I just can't imagine how they pulled it all together. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I mean, Michelle Yeoh is literally playing like 100 different characters. It's a wild, wild movie.
Yeah, and I have more comments on Michelle Yeoh's performance, but they would give things away. So if there are people who are doing the late binge of all the candidates ahead of the Oscars, I won't do that other than to say I thought she was very deserving of that award. Although I personally still have Banshees of Inisherin as my top one of 2022, but that's because if you wanted to get me interested in a movie, just being drunk and sad in rural Ireland, that's a really, really, really good start. Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, Cinephile Pod, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Blake and Shia, pleasure. And the best part of Banshees, and I'm with you, Blake, it was also my favorite film of the year, is you can't walk out of that movie and not talk to everybody with an Irish accent, especially when you're talking about your feckin' donkey.
Yeah, I can't go full Irish. I could do a Newfie accent, but I won't subject anyone to that. Adnan Virk, thanks so much, man.
Thanks, boys. Take care.
That was Adnan Virk, MLB Network, NHL Network, Cinephile Pod. He will return next week to talk to us some more. Also returning is the Toronto Boat Show. It's returning to Enercare Center for its 65th anniversary, January 20th to the 29th. We're giving away tickets to the event and ballots for a chance to win their grand prize, a Princecraft fishing boat with a Mercury engine and trailer. We also have our own VIP prize, which includes dinner for two, a $100 shopping spree at the show, and a one-night stay at the Westin Harbor Castle. Just listen for the code word in our show today until January 16th. Then text that code word to 590-590, and you'll be entered for a chance to win. Today's code word is anniversary. We have another code word tomorrow, so be sure to tune in again. Text those to 590-590, your chance to win any of those great prizes. We're going to take a break. When we come back, talk a little bit more about this Austin Matthews injury, what the Leafs could look like tonight without him, TJ Brody concern, and Chris Chilton, not a teacher, but she handed out some midseason report cards around the NHL. She joins us next as Fan Drive Time continues on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to Fan Drive Time. I'm Blake Murphy, Shai Davidi alongside me. We got Predators at Leafs at 7:30 tonight on Sportsnet Television. Joining us now to answer the big, big questions, NHL reporter for ESPN, Kristen Chilton. Kristen, Ryan Reynolds making the rounds. Do we see him at Scotiabank Arena tonight?
I mean, it's got to be his next stop, right? I mean, he's all over the Eastern Conference. It's, you know, who's he going to be kissing in the crowd in Toronto? That's what I want to know. I want to know who he'd be betting on. If there was a former player in the crowd in Toronto, who would Ryan Reynolds be finding there? That's the real question.
Well, certainly no one with the kissing appeal of Henrik Lundqvist. But,
or the hair.
Yeah, or the hair. I don't know. You know, I'll volunteer as tribute if he needs someone to watch the game with. But no guesses on that. If he is there tonight, Kristen, he will not see Austin Matthews. He's out day-to-day with an undisclosed injury. What is the concern level closer to the team? Because all we have publicly is it's day-to-day and we're not telling you what it is, but he's not on the IR. Internally, around that team, is it as kind of light and fluffy as that, or is there more of an underlying concern?
Well, I think that the fact Toronto has been playing well and Matthews has still been playing well, despite what Sheldon Keefe called a lingering issue, I think it's probably a lower level of concern given that they are taking him out of the lineup for almost what seems like a precautionary reason or an opportunity at this juncture to really get him fully healthy. And you know, I know that there was this expectation that, you know, he was going to come in and be putting up like a billion points and building off of the season that he had in an even bigger way from last year. And, you know, there's, of course, the immediate speculation that whatever this injury is, it's what's been holding him back, et cetera. And if there is any truth to that, if it has been holding him back in some way, I think you're feeling, if you're the Leafs, like, well, you're still, you know, you've got a great player who's still on track to have something like a 90-point season with where he's at. But this is a moment where I think if the concern level, you know, was high for Matthews, they would have taken him out sooner. But this is a point where they can slip him out and there's enough depth, there's enough confidence in the team's ability to respond well to that, that this is the moment where they're going to do it. So I think if you were trying to gauge how the team feels about where Matthews is, it's really reflected in the fact that he's coming out now. They're going on this road trip, whether he comes along or not, but they have a lot of time right now. You know, they've had some good days off. They were off Monday. They're going to be off after a back-to-back. They might be off again when they come home. There's some days off here for Matthews to get well, and that should be the absolute priority, because if you don't take care of these little things now, they can become big things down the road.
Kristen, when you watch Matthews play this season, points production aside, what do you see something different this year compared to last? Like, in what ways is his game different from a year ago?
You know, I don't necessarily see something different in his game. I think that what even players of Matthews' stature learn is just how the league can adjust to you. And especially when you're on a pedestal the way that he was last year, you come back into this season and teams are ready for it. Like, if he surprised anyone last season with how much he was able to do and how he was able to do it, I mean, they had a whole summer to prepare for the attack that he was going to bring again. And I think that's always just something that for players, especially, you know, they have these huge seasons, and then sometimes you do see, they come back and it's a struggle to reach that level again, but they find a way, because the best players like Matthews, they're always going to adjust their game. They're always going to find different ways to contribute. It just doesn't always happen as quickly and easily as you think that it might. So I don't necessarily see a change in Matthews or his style, or obviously his skill and speed at the same time. I don't see a change in all of that. I think there's obviously been some personnel moves as well for the Leafs. He's playing with some different line mates. It hasn't been the same Michael Bunting as it was a year ago. That's been different for Matthews as well. They obviously had such a terrific chemistry last year. And there's just different factors. And I think for Matthews, you know, this lingering issue aside, it's just a matter of how are you going to kind of reinvent what you do so well every single year, because that's what the best players can do. And that's what Matthews, I think, will continue to do here in the second half once he's, feeling like he's going to make that return to the lineup.
The Leafs have, like you mentioned, Kristen, the runway here to be cautious with this. And that's because they played so well, and also because the standings are what they are, with Boston well ahead and the Leafs at extremely little risk of falling far enough down the standings for their playoff spot to be in jeopardy. One of the other things that the Leafs have going for them is, historically, they've performed pretty well when Auston Matthews is out of the lineup. I think that's a testament to their depth and the way other people step up. How important is William Nylander for that, especially with him moving to center and Pierre Engvall moving up onto that line tonight, and I'd imagine move as long as Auston Matthews is out?
Yeah, you know, I always thought in all the time I've spent around William Nylander, I think he likes the challenge of that center role, and yet no coach has put him there permanently. I think because they like more of what he can do on the wing, but it's that versatility, it's that change of pace that I think really does bring something different out of Nylander. And whether that's something that would be a long-term change ever for him, maybe not. But I do think that in those small doses, it shakes out the cobwebs, right? It's a different challenge. It's something that I think he kind of thrives on when he's given the assignment. So that's where, you know, you're looking to Nylander to step into, you know, a place that, you know, is almost like it's a little uncomfortable. And that's what makes it comfortable, is that he has that experience there from his past. But you're expecting for him to bring the same, I think, consistency that we've seen from him this season, not just on the offensive side, but the defensive side. You're seeing him lift sticks. You're seeing him get into more battles in the corner. You're seeing a more desperate, I think, William Nylander with each passing year, because he knows as well as anybody that the opportunities to be a good team and as you just described, to be a club that has a good chance in the playoff picture, you know, with where they're at right now, you just don't want to keep seeing those opportunities slip away. And the more they do, the more you embrace the challenge. And this is going to be another one for him. And, you know, you look at somebody like Engvall. I always think there's a little bit more you can get out of Engvall, and maybe playing with a William Nylander, a chance that you don't necessarily have if an Austin Matthews is in the lineup. You know, this is something where I think Engvall can benefit as well. And that only helps to bolster that depth as well that Toronto has been really lucky to have. So I think when you look at the way Keith is juggling his lines, it's about maybe putting players in places that they can succeed, even if they're not necessarily ones that you would want them in long term, because it's that short term challenge where it really does bring out the best in them.
Kristen, you just mentioned Pierre Engvall there as one of the players who can maybe has another gear to give if he's put into a bit of a different role. And obviously the Leafs aren't at a point where they're thinking this is going to be long term for Austin Matthews or anything like that. But if you look at the roster, and if for some reason Matthews has to miss a significant amount of time, is there anyone else who you're looking at is saying this is someone who with a bit more opportunity could take a step forward that just needs a bit more ice time, a bit more responsibility, can make a jump as well as, you know, Nylander and Engvall?
You know, I like Alex Kerfoot's season. I think he has been able to do a lot of good things as well. But whenever, you know, you lose, you know, one of those top line guys, you're always kind of looking down the lineup and saying, okay, who else maybe has been quieter, maybe hasn't been scoring as many timely goals or having as much of that, you know, those impacts at like the key moments, and who could be that guy? And I could see Kerfoot being someone who maybe grabs a hold of a little bit more opportunity if he can. Callie Yarncroft is another one who has just been such a, I think, an underrated, unheralded signing for the Leafs. And obviously he's had a great year as well, but I'm looking at those two guys because, and it's nothing against obviously what they've produced so far. I think they've been really solid, but you're always thinking, okay, if Matthews is out, that means there's going to be more attention on Mitch Marner, John Tavares, William Nylander, et cetera. And so you've got to look to those depth pieces, those key cogs in the overall machine, and just say, okay, well, how are you going to get a little more greasy here? How are you going to get, you know, and sort of highlight even more of what you do well? And if we go back to Engvall, you know, I always think that there's just a little bit more he could bring physically. Like, you just wonder if he could be, you know, use that big body of his and really push guys off of pucks. That's how you can have an impact on the top line. It doesn't always have to be scoring when a player like Matthews goes out. It's also, you know, hey, how are we going to fill these other voids? And I just think Engvall could do more in that respect, where yes, he can score goals and yes, he can bring the offense, but how about some physicality? How about a little bit more, you know, punch? And these are those moments where you'd like to see an expansion of, you know, not just thinking, okay, well, how are we going to, you know, fill the net, but just how are we going to fill the void in other ways as well? And I think Engvall might be one of those untapped, that might be some untapped potential for him that he could roll out now, depending on how long Matthews is missing.
We'll also see the NHL debut of Newfoundland Growlers legend Bobby McMahon getting the call up from the Marlies, almost a point a game for the Marlies this year. And Kristen, the way you just laid out the Leafs' ability to have guys step up and play different roles and kind of come through despite all the blue line injuries and Austin Matthews not being, as you said, giving them Herculean efforts night to night, was part of why in your report cards, the midseason grades for all 32 NHL teams over at ESPN, you and Ryan Clark put them together. You gave the Leafs an A. Their opponent tonight, the Nashville Predators, got a big ol' C-. What's going wrong in Nashville? This is a team I think a lot of people expected to be at least a little bit better than this.
Absolutely. I had really high hopes for Nashville. I thought that they, and that's why, you know, it was hard to grade them that low, because it was really just, there's so much potential there. They have just no ability to score. and you look at the seasons that like Matt Duchene had last year and Ryan Johansson and Mikael Granlund and, you know, they added Nito Niederreiter, and it's Niederreiter who's, you know, he's right behind Philip Forsberg for, you know, second in goals on the team, and he's only got 12. And it's just, you're just seeing such a lack of goal support. And they relied so heavily on UC Saros last year. You saw how quickly the wheels fell off in the postseason when Saros wasn't available. Nashville gets swept out by Colorado. But you really, and I absolutely thought they were going to come in this season and Saros was going to be healthy and they were going to get those, you know, great performances out of their offensive lineup. And it just hasn't happened. And that's where the disappointment is that it's just the sense that there's more for the Predators and that they should be getting better from some of these really talented forwards. I mean, even Forsberg, he's been good, but it's sort of like same with, you know, you talk about a Herculean effort from Matthews. You can't just expect because he signed a big contract that he's going to be able to do it all. And I thought that Nashville would really firmly be in the Central Division, you know, top three. And that's just, you know, they've been in and out of a wild card spot. They just haven't, you look at Dallas and the other, top Central Division teams. And is it that surprising? No, because they're so potent offensively and Nashville just hasn't been there. But it's a tough go when you're again relying on Saros. Maybe not as much, but it's tough to win in this league if you can't score. And Nashville certainly hasn't found the recipe there yet for consistent offense.
Kristen, before I let you go, I know you read about a billion books in 2022. I'm about to start Sea of Tranquility by the excellent Canadian author Emily St. John Mandel on your recommendation. Have you gotten underway with your 2023 reading list yet? And if so, what struck you early on?
Yes, I am on book three of 2023. Yeah, I really took advantage of the slower week that we had right after the new year. But I'm very happy so far with my start. I've gotten to read two really good books. Sarah Polley's Run Toward the Danger was something that I had been looking to read last year and didn't get around to it. But I would highly recommend if you like reading about just a great Canadian and a great Canadian storyteller. It was my favorite of the 2.5 that I've read so far, for sure.
Kristen Shilton, excellent for book recommendations, excellent for NHL coverage, especially with the Leafs. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kristen.
Kristen Shilton, NHL reporter for ESPN. Fun Leaf game ahead tonight. We'll see how they look without Austin Matthews. Also, Shy, just a tiny, tiny bit of Jays news. John Heyman letting us know that the Jays have signed Jay Jackson to a minor league deal with an invite to spring training. Not that anyone, we're still in the Brandon Belt phase of the offseason. We're not looking at spring training invitees yet. But I had wanted to ask you a little earlier in the show. We kind of ran out of time when we were talking baseball. When you look at this team, you could conceivably point to, I think, three areas that are worth addressing if there's room left in the budget or the right guy finds them. And that is a right-handed bat who can play some outfield so that you're not one injury away from Whit Merrifield being an everyday outfielder. An extra starter for depth, because you can never have too many of those, even if you got Zach Thompson. And relief pitching help. Now, the relief pitching depth is obviously there, but this is a team that has at least talked like maybe they'd like some more back end stuff. If you're the Blue Jays and you've just got the one bullet left, which of those three things is your priority at this point?
Ooh, if you're only going one way.
Yeah, the answer should be all of them.
Yes.
Just keep spending and keep adding.
I think right now where you're probably thinnest is starting pitching, right? And I think Zach Thompson, Drew Hutchison on the minor league deal late last week, all this is about not being in the situation they were in last September, where they had three bullpen games in 14, 15 days, whatever it was, and not being in that position again. And I don't know that they're sort of imminently in that spot right now, but pitching can fall apart quick. And the toughest commodity to get is semi-reliable or viable starting pitching. And, you know, I think in the ideal Blue Jays world, Ricky Tiedemann or Hayden Younger is coming up at some point this year and is factoring for this team, or that, you know, Yusei Kikuchi is back to normal and all of a sudden allaying some of the concerns about him and how he fits. But I don't know that you want to count on any of that stuff. So I think if you're attacking one area there, I do believe they'd still like to add someone else who's got a chance to be a back-end bullpen type. And, you know, you probably want a lefty mashing, right-handed hitting outfielder who can spot in certain points in time, depending on the matchup. So
sure would like Robbie Grossman.
Yeah, I think he'd probably want more role, but someone like Trey Mancini to me would be a tremendous fit. And I think there was, you know, there was some engagement there at least earlier in the offseason. I'm not sure whether he's going to probably have an opportunity with more role somewhere else, but you know, something like that to me makes sense. Robbie Grossman as well. And I know the Blue Jays a couple of trade deadlines ago certainly, you know, talked to the Detroit Tigers about him when he was there, and obviously there was no deal struck. So that's my thinking right now. Like, and I feel like they acknowledged they didn't get enough pitching and the minor league side, kind of fill out Buffalo last year. They thought they'd be okay with what they had, and maybe, you know, everything was so crazy coming out of the lockout, they just didn't have the time to put all that stuff together.
Mm-hmm. But, and it could have been worse, because they found, like, Platinum Max was not supposed to be in the mix at all. Like, he was a non-guy, and then they got, I know he turned back into a pumpkin in KC, but, like, they got more out of that guy than they had any right to expect. So it could have been even worse.
Yeah, and at a really important time mm-hmm. for them, too, where if he wasn't giving them those innings, they would have been in really deep into scramble mode. So, you know, I don't know. This is a Blue Jays team that's scarred by the memories of having to, like, go out and find a Mike Hochschild to make a start under emergency circumstances. It's not a situation you want to be in where they are right now. And, you know, you'd think that with the front four they have in Manoa, Gausman, Berríos, and Bassett, that there's not going to be much of a concern there. But, look, injuries come up out of the blue all the time. And that's the one area where if you're in trouble, it has, you know, the spinoff effects of that are all over your roster.
Well, we saw last year too, suddenly Ross Stripling's in your rotation and he was awesome, but then your bullpen's a little weaker and then you're stretching for a Mitch White and it kind of snowballs from there. So maybe there's still something to Dylan Bundy. I'll never give up. I'll never give up the ghost on that. That's a conversation for a little closer to spring. Maybe we'll get some stuff later in the week. Right now though, it's time for Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. So the Leafs got the Predators tonight. They're -180 favorites. The Toronto Maple Leafs are always favorites. It's you know, especially here in Ontario where those books are region specific. Predators coming in at +155. If you wanted to get a little extra juice, Leafs -1 is -118. Some of the goal scorer props, you know, they get a little more interesting with Austin Matthews out of the lineup. Although he's still listed right now, I would bet no, he doesn't score tonight in a game that he's not playing in.
It's a good bet to make.
Yeah. William Nylander +148 is the top Leaf there. And on the Nashville side, Philip Forsberg +165. He's been that team's only real offense for a good stretch. We can also look ahead to the NFL wildcard weekend. Those lines are always exciting to look at. A pretty big swing in the Bills game now that we know Tua will not be playing. Bills -13, which is just about as big a playoff line as you're going to find anywhere. A couple of tighter ones with the Cowboys -2.5 at Tampa Bay. The Vikings -3 at home against the Giants, and my Jaguars 2-point dogs at home against the Chargers. The disrespect, 7-2 over their last 9. Shy,
I'm curious. When you were did you watch The Good Place? Like, how did you feel about Jason's portrayal of being a Jags fan?
Yeah, I loved it. And Macho Man Randy Savage, non-international airport. The jokes are great. It was awesome. I was actually in Long Beach this weekend and saw someone in a Blake Bortles jersey.
Oh, man.
They did not, however, return my yell of Duval They maybe didn't know that the Jaguars had won moments before we ran into each other. I was at a concert and just like refreshing my phone constantly, being that jerk at a concert. But the Jaguars have played precious few meaningful football games.
I'm telling you, if you had the dedication to get a Bortles jersey, I mean, you should be answering that yell.
I still have a Byron Leftwich jersey kicking around somewhere. It's not quite as Bortlesy as Bortles, but it's there. That was Last Call, brought to you by Bet Rivers. It's a whole new game. I've been Blake Murphy. This is Shai Davidi. We'll be back with you Thursday and Friday. We'll break down Leafs Preds. We'll tee up Raptors tomorrow. We'll continue to talk about these big NFL storylines heading into wildcard weekend. Shai, thanks so much, man. This is a pleasure.
Yeah, pleasure.
All right, we'll talk to you guys tomorrow on Fan Drive Time on Sports at 590 The Fan.